Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is Pat Prescott from The Morning Show, and we are talking to individuals who are making waves in the African-American community in honor of Black History Month. And one of our honorees this year is someone who is just near and dear to my heart. I guess we've known each other, I'm trying to think how many years it is.
It's got
to
be 15
plus. I remember
plus.
When we met. It was at a MOST event.
Yes,
motivating
but that was
our
so. That seems like
experience.
So long ago.
It's it was a while ago. It's got to be over 10 years.
Yeah, I was going to say it's at least 10.
At least
14.
10 years.
Yeah.
But she is Cynthia St. James, a renowned artist, a multicultural visual artist, award-winning author, and illustrator of 17 children's books, several poetry and affirmation books, a cookbook, a play, a monologue, two marketing books, and her latest book, Living My Dream, the 50th anniversary celebration, is one in which Cynthia shares her creative journey, a journey that has reached a very important milestone during this, the month of February.
Exactly.
Welcome. We'll get into that. Actually, tell us about that right now. What's happening
in
February?
You. Well, for me, this month is all about me turning 70.
Secondary. Oh, that is kind of awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. But on another level, career level is so important because I was 20 in New York, sold my first painting.
Wow.
Yes. So that marks 50 years
so
from
this
that.
Is your 50th anniversary,
50th anniversary
as a working artist.
Yes, pro. As a pro.
As a pro.
Yes.
Well, we're going to get into your story today because that's what this program really is all about. We believe that everyone has a story, certainly. But people like yourself who have great accomplishments often have a lot of great things that have happened to them and some not so great things that have happened as well. Many of those, the things, however, that shaped our character.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to go all the way back. Let's go back to the Bronx, New York, to where it all started for one Cynthia St. James. And we see the cutest little picture on Living My Dream. Of how old were you when
Five.
This picture was taken?
When
Five
I knew I wanted
old.
To be an artist when I grew up. That's why I put it on the cover.
Was that one of your earliest memories during that period?
Yes. Yes, I knew I wanted to be an artist.
What was it that made you want to be an artist?
You know, I can't even pinpoint it. It wasn't. I know that we used to, my brothers and sisters, we used to sit around and color, you know, coloring books, that typical stuff. Of course, it was always a little competitive. Mine is better than yours, you know, that little whiny stuff. But I can't actually explain it, but I knew it wasn't like frivolous be an artist. It was like be an artist for my life. That will be my career.
Had you ever encountered any artists? Do you remember the first time you ever met anyone who did what this was that you wanted to do?
No, but I can remember something that later in my early teens, the first Moulin Rouge. Remember the first with Jose Ferrer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Something about that cemented it in a way that said, but these are the things that are not going to happen in my life. I'm going to live to take care of myself through my art, okay? I'm not going to become a total dipsomaniac. Right. And I was going to remain healthy, you know, but I was going to focus on that and not let the obstacles wear me out and get me down. So since I sold my first painting at 20, I've had 50 million other jobs, but I was already started making somewhat of a living from my art.
Let's go back to when you were 5 years old and you decided that you wanted to be an artist. What did that look like in your life? Do you remember the early engagement that you had with creating things?
Just coloring and drawing, you know, nothing that really, I was not this prodigy or anything. But it's just something that made me happy.
Did anybody encourage or discourage you?
At that time, no. As I got older, not much older, by the time I was 6, my mom was my biggest encouragement. Okay, she started buying me extra stuff to draw and stuff because she could tell I was serious.
Mm-hmm.
So she saw that at me being 6.
Were you serious as a little girl, period? I mean,
oh, no. I was a tomboy up at the top of the... Couldn't get me down from climbing all poor babysitters, sliding, you know, those steps like in the Bronx that you can slide down to the next street.
Mm-hmm.
5 years old, cardboard sliding down. I was just a maniac. First day of school, coming home, but I can't just walk out the gate. I get my head stuck in the gate because I have to see if it fits through. You know, no.
Adventurous.
Very adventurous.
And you can see that quality in your work, too. You know,
I'm still adventurous.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Seriously. So now, as you got older, when you got into high school and that during that whole period, did they have arts in the schools?
Well, you know
time?
What, which is very unusual for a lot of people when I tell them I've never studied art. I'm self-taught. What we had back then, junior high school, I had an elective. I got to have a drawing class, but you didn't really learn to draw. You just got a grade because it was an elective. Mm-hmm. And then the same thing in high school. I had a chance to do that. But everything I've ever had is liberal arts until in my early 20s, I went into theater arts, but I have never really had a serious art study.
How does one who has never had any art study, has never had the influences of having other artists around them, just take this natural talent and actually become a successful artist who has done what you have done, which you set out to do, to make a living mm-hmm. doing this thing that you love?
Yeah. You know what? It's just the simplest way to put it, I believe, is that it's a gift from the Creator. And with that gift comes a responsibility, because you're gifted and you don't use it. That is something really messed up. That's horrible. And the also responsibility is to share it, to help through your art. So those are the things that are foremost for me. I'm not happy when I'm not painting. I mean, I just, and it can't wait too long because I just don't feel right.
Yes, well, you are prolific. You can, look, I see your Metro trains riding by all the time. I'm like, there's Cynthia St. James' work on that train. That in and of itself is incredible. But you know, going back to, you were saying that this is the anniversary now mm-hmm. of your beginning to be a professional artist, a pro, because you sold your first painting 50
yes.
years ago this month. Tell us the story of that first sale and what was it that you sold?
Okay, that was 1969, so abstracts were in vogue for sure. And I was working for a mortgage insurance company on Fifth Avenue right across from St. Patrick as an accounts receivable clerk. But every time I got paid, I was buying art supplies. So one of the closers, one of the attorneys, which I always remember his name, Daniel Fishman, saw me doing this, and I'd say he took a leap when he said, "Can I commission you to do something for me, for my apartment?" And so I was in total shock that I was actually going to get paid, and someone hadn't even seen what I can do. And I created the painting, and now you got to remember, too, I'm working in Manhattan, and I'm all the way up on 224th Street in the Bronx. So I'm carrying canvases all the way up there and bringing them back on the subway. I bring it into my office, and I'm kind of feeling shy, very shy about this. And I show him the painting, and I end up with more commissions from other coworkers. But he beat him to the punch. He commissioned a second one on the spot. He told me how much to charge, because what were they making back then in the village? So most street artists, if they had an original painting, it was around $75 was a good price. And that was a perfect price, because my rent for my apartment, partially furnished, was $125 a month.
So that was
$75,
most of your rent.
You know, for painting. You know, so you have to really look at that in perspective. The Polaroid camera just came out, so I bought a Polaroid camera to document my work. I'm going to get real serious about this. Art supplies, and I bought my boyfriend a gift and had change. Okay? So that's the difference with the money, you know.
So that first painting was an abstract.
Yes.
Okay, so talk about how you developed your style, because it is unique. There's always a great deal of color involved. I've never seen one of your paintings that looked sad. They always make me feel very happy. And you've also got the faces with no features
right,
on many of them.
Yes,
the featureless faces.
Uh-huh.
You can tell a Cynthia St. James piece when you see it. It is different.
The only painting that I did that felt sad is the Mark Taper Forum back in 90 commissioned me to do the piece for Miss Evers Boys. But still, it sold out. It was one of the first posters that ever sold out, and they had to put some in the archives. So it wasn't that sad, the downcast body language and duller colors, but yeah.
But that was a really sad
yes,
story,
I had to do,
a sad occasion.
I had to do
yes.
that, yeah.
That was appropriate. That was somber.
Right. Yeah. But it amazed me that it's sold out, you know.
But where did the style come from?
I mean, how did you develop the style? Came from me constantly saying, oh, can you do this? Let's try this. Well, let's whatever. So the featureless came from a visit to Martinique in 1984-85 that I saw all of these market scenes and crowds of people. And I challenged myself to create people featureless that you could feel their culture, their disposition, and their age. And that's when I started to do it. And then I did cultures of the world, and I did that for several countries, you know, different cultures. And that's how I started to develop it. But what's really important is prior to that, I was doing portraits of kids for people, realistically. Mm-hmm. My eyes watched you everywhere you went before that, wild domestic animals. And I knew that no one would ever steal anything out of my place because if you came in, lions and tigers and bears are staring at you. And they look at you. I learned how to do that from another self-taught artist with eyes.
So that the eyes looked at you wherever you went.
Oh, yes, yes.
But then you decided to just get rid of eyes altogether.
Well, yeah. Thing is like saying, knowing that you can do all these things and you're not stepping back because you can't, but you're stepping into your own style after all those years. But I definitely learned. I mean, I had an exhibit and a group show in Paris in 1980 that were my wild and domestic animals. You wouldn't look at that and ever think it was me. Right. Yeah.
She's a chameleon artist.
Yes.
Do you still do work other than what has become known as your style?
Yes, I do. Yes, I just finished doing something that really kind of threw people off. And I told them, calm down, it's not happening anytime soon. I did a kabuki lion dancer. And he's all made up, but I made his eyes realistic so that he's looking at you. You know, and one person I gave a magnet to said that she kept looking at the magnet. Her husband kept saying, what's wrong with you? Why do you keep looking at the refrigerator? She said, because he keeps looking at me. See? So even then, this guy, he's like, he's powerful in his dance, but he's looking at you. Yeah. And then I do a lot of landscapes and seascapes.
Yes, I've seen some of that work,
right,
which
yes.
is lovely. And a lot of that, I think you have a fascination with color.
Oh, yes.
That I think is very special. Talk about that a little bit.
Kid in a candy store. So if I go into a store, those are the colors that pull me. And so I've got to have those bright colors. And then I paint 7 to 9 or 10 coats of that color on the canvas. So it's even brighter and brighter and brighter.
So that's where you get the depth, because there is great depth of color in everything that you do.
Yes, it's like serious, like teal, that's about 9 or 10 coats, depending on the colors, how much the intensity.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, now that I think about it, as I look at your work, you know, you mentioned your mother and her support. Talk a little bit about how much that has meant to you. And I'd love to hear more about your family. And
okay.
For all of us, I know we have people in our lives that have made a big impact on us. And even though, you know, they didn't have to teach you art, there are other things that we learn from people that help us along our successful journey.
Well, you know, her favorite song was Keep On Pushing. Okay, so all of us grew up on that. Even my younger brothers and sisters, they grew up on that. But, you know, it's just things that moms do. It's like care packages, food, whatever they could do. I remember, you know, it's not like she had a bunch of money, but I remember one time suddenly there was some money in my checking account, you know, like that. And then my little sister Trina is almost like my daughter sister because she's 14 years younger than me. And so she's like always there, like if I'm doing something or I'm doing a show or if I'm doing a private thing at my house, she's there. She brings all the food. She likes to set up stuff and, you know, it's that kind of support. And more recently, another one of my sisters, Tanya. So that's been the greatest support. Yeah.
So now, how did you end up, this little New York girl from the Bronx, how'd you end up out here in Southern California?
You know, sometimes I often wonder. But my grandmother moved to California first. She was originally, I just got this new thing that I'm not sure where she was from, but she was from the South. I thought she was from like South Carolina. Just recently, a cousin or something said, no, she was from Georgia, but whatever. She migrated very young, probably a teenager, to New York. So that's where my mother was born and raised, and my father was born and raised in New York as well. So that's all they really knew. But because grandmother lived here, you know, there was a couple of visits. And then finally, when that family decided to become split up, here we were. My mom put her little kids together and we got on the plane. And that was something back then. Remember that kind of, you package your sandwiches in some kind of wax paper.
Wax paper, yes.
And the crust still got hard.
Mm-hmm. I remember that well. This is how we used to wrap our sandwiches for lunch and,
right.
for trips, those trips.
Right.
You would take your food along with you.
Sure. So I remember just being, and then I remember getting here and looking out the window and seeing mailmen actually pushing a cart. We didn't have that in New York. I never saw no mailman pushing no cart with stuff. You know, and at first I was looking for where the horses were, because this is the Wild West. I was looking for the horses and... You know. Still, I mean, it's the same kid.
How old were you then?
I was 6.
Oh, you were only 6 years old when you moved out here.
Yeah.
All right, so you just really had no choice in the matter at all.
But it was like this. I found out later, my mom told me. I came home from school, and everyone was talking about my accent, because I had a very, very thick accent when I was younger. I came home, and I felt all exotic and whatever, and I asked. I told my mom, and she said, but you were born here. And it totally burst my bubble. So at 6, I found out that I was born in California. At 2, I was in New York.
Okay.
So from 2 to 6 and 18 to 23, the wonder years of growth, I lived in New York. So that has a lot to do with who I am. I think I'm more in New York than California, except that I, of course, love the beach and palm trees and all that. But my energy is more of an East Coast energy.
And that New York energy, talk about it. Talk about that period, especially when you were a young adult mm-hmm. in New York City and what that experience meant for you as an artist.
Well, you know, later I look back on the song, If You Can Make It Here, You Can Make It Anywhere, New York, New York. But since I sold my first painting in New York, I already had a good foot out there. Big toe was sticking out on its way. I learned more of assertiveness in New York that has always remained with me. You know, still not really loud or out there, not an introvert, but quietly making things happen. But it's that energy. It's the New York energy. It's not the laid back, waiting for something to happen energy.
What about artistically? Because there's so much culture that's available in New York. Oh. Were you inspired by any of that? Any alliances that you made during that young adult period? Other artists who became friends maybe who...
I still didn't have any artist friends or anything. In high school, I had friends that majored in art and all that, but I never did. I just remembered being so excited when the Museum of Modern Art opened. So I didn't work too far from there. So I would go to the Museum of Modern Art at lunchtime and to my art store down the street. And, you know, I guess I was doing it on my own without really. I know more about New York now and going back, when I go back, where I would want to go and what I want to see. Because I've had work in the Schomburg. I had an exhibit on Park Avenue. Seagram's my first corporative commission. You know, I was back in, when was that? 1989, 1990. My first corporative, you know, Intercontinental Hotel, First Glass, $100 allowance on room service a day, stuff like, you know, that was something different.
That was a big deal.
That was a big difference. But I learned more about New York, the energy that way, from exhibits like that and other exhibits I've had in New York.
So then moving forward and talking about what's going on with you now, how does one maintain a career like yours? I think a part of it is to find these little niche areas for yourself, and you've done a mm-hmm. great job with that. The very first time I ever saw your work was on Terry McMillan's books. You got chosen as the artist that was going to do hers.
It.
And yeah, she chose you to do that.
No, she actually she already had the piece hanging in her house. She had a reproduction of it.
Tell us about that.
But Terry got my phone number from a gallery in Oakland that she had bought a print ensemble from, which is the cover. And she didn't like what her publisher, the art director, had done, and called me. And she said the painting looked like if the woman's eyes was closed, she was dead. That's how she explained it. And she says, is there any way possible? But she also said, probably don't know who I am. You know, she was very unassuming. And she had that painting, and she told me, the print, she told me later that where she wrote the book, primarily that piece was there. And it just happens to be the exact number of women, 4 and all that. And so she called and she asked me first, and then she told the art director that's who it's going to be.
And so I would imagine a friendship developed from that.
Oh, yeah. It's funny because she said she'd never seen such excitement over a book cover, you know. And in fact, she couldn't even ever swallow the fact that she felt like they were making her a rock star, you know. So it's that kind of feeling. And then it went international. I did license to Japan, to Germany, to England, on and on and on from that. But that book cover also was the reason why companies came to me to do children's picture books. They asked me if I was interested because of the colors. Not knowing anything about them, I said yes. I'm going to do it. I'm going to learn. Whatever I don't know, I'm going to ask. I'm going to figure it out.
So being open is a big part of it, isn't it?
Yes, and being willing to at times reinvent yourself, being extremely open even when your knees are shaking. Like the 150 feet I did for Ontario Airport, that scared me to death when I looked on that list, and I shook my head quietly, smiling, but I was really saying a lot of stuff. And and I said, they must be kidding. And do they think I'm Michelangelo? I mean, all these thoughts were going through my head. And then the curator said, Cynthia, you can design it. A ceramic tile person will, you know, create it for you. And so that took the edge off, you know, that can happen.
You know, you didn't have to go put the tiles up on the, have to paint each tile put that up there.
There's no way 150 feet.
It's a whole process. I mean, those things always fascinate me when you take art and then reproduce it on a large scale like that.
Yes.
That must be, much involved in that.
To me, it was terrifying. I had just done a little stamp and I had to paint it real tiny, 4 by 5 inches. And here's somebody asking me to do something, 150. And I'll tell you who got it. Got me through that. Sade's Greatest Hits. I played it the whole time. I designed almost 3 feet by 150 feet. Sade kept me cool, and I kept creating the piece.
This is in the Ontario Airport?
Yeah.
And so now when you go to the airport, how does it feel to stand next to your work? Do you ever fly in and out of that airport?
Not generally, but the times I've gone, it's just amazing. It's been on some television programs and even commercials, you know, that it's in the background that you have to send me something to, you know, so I could say sign off that it can be seen. But yeah, it's amazing.
Now, you mentioned the Kwanzaa stamp, which has become famous, and this is a piece that I know I've seen this in many, many, many people's homes, actually. Mm-hmm. How did that come to be?
Someone called me up. It was a designer, Terry.
It's good. It's good for you to answer your phone.
And now my finger's always off. But anyway, I answered the phone. So that was 1996. And I wondered how the U.S. Postal Service got my phone number. As a good New Yorker, I don't list my number. That was my first thought. But she asked me, she said, would I be interested in doing a Kwanzaa stamp? You know, and I'm going like, okay. And I wondered why me. Later found out that she saw a book cover of another children's book writer that I had done the cover for. But they hadn't seen my book. I had one out too, Gifts of Kwanzaa. So the PR from when I was in the record business sent her a whole packet. And it's sweet. And I was not being like this. I just feel like you should follow up and let people know. And she asked me, it was so sweet, she said, do you have time to do the Kwanzaa stamp? And she called me. And I said, of course. I mean, you know, I was just sharing. So that came about. And the hardest part, Pat, I was supposed to not tell anybody till it came out. By the time they told me I couldn't, I had already been in Barbados. And I was on the cover of one of the newspapers there of having just created the Kwanzaa stamp.
Too late.
And then that same week, the Girl Scouts, the USA, called me and asked me to do their 85th anniversary piece. So that was 1 week that I called my All-American week.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I think the most astounding thing for that stamp is that it was a 32, 33, 34, 37. It sold 318 million. Hello?
Do you get residuals on those stamps?
flat fee, baby.
Wow.
Yeah, but that's copyright. You know, the government. I don't sell my copyright, but there's no choice with stamps.
But what an honor.
It's the honor. And then I did the 2016 Forever Kwanzaa stamp.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. But I think one of the most outstanding things I've ever seen is when I first saw a Metro train drive by with Cynthia St. James' work all on the side of it. You've got a picture of that also on your book, Living My Dream, the 50th anniversary celebration. Uh-huh. And how did that deal come to be?
I was a friend of mine, Barbara Perkins, Sisters at the Well, and We See You Awards. I created her We See You Award. So that was a painting that people just keep getting reproductions. And one of the young ladies at one of her events when I was on, we were raising money for Haiti, and she, you know, saw me there, and she asked Barbara if she think I would be interested in doing something. AARP commissioned me to do that painting. And so the young lady was part of that outreach, the multicultural outreach. And they came to me, her and another representative from New York. And I created a, 20 by 60 inch painting. And then the graphic designer broke it up in segments to make it fit in different areas on the train.
So once again, you turn the work over to them and say, you all figure it out from here. Make it bigger and make it so it'll stay on the train.
Right. You do that part. And it's coming up later this year. There's some paintings that I did for an affordable living complex, but also for vets and people with any kinds of challenges. That's going to be reproduced by muralists four stories high.
Wow.
Yes. They will be up on those scaffolds, not me. But yeah, that's exciting.
And then you have to stand in front of it, you know. And here's little Cynthia St.
A little
James.
Little peanut.
With this huge monstrosity of a picture behind you, which
yes.
is amazing.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Now, of the things that you've done, what are some of your pieces that you love the most? I mean, with someone who has done as much work as you have, I'm sure there are many, but is anything that stand out that maybe a couple of things that you really, really like?
It's so tough because each one is a new baby, but I keep a lot of my own work because they're all designated to different museums. I've done all that. Prior to me getting out of here, I know where the babies are going. I would say, yes, that's and definitely in New York. I have a couple of the Sean Burford Moores going to the Studio Museum in Harlem and on and on. But I would say the series I did on Haiti, which is 14 pieces, that whole series, I evidently had done enough of my work with HBCUs and stuff. I had enough money in the bank that I was just going like this. I was turning them out, but they were all spiritual things that were coming out of me that I wanted to release and put out there and share. That series, there's so many different series, so it's hard to say. One of the pieces in that series is called Souvenirs, and they're all in white. And they're around this big Maipo tree. And it's a celebrating where we come from Africa, our African ancestry. And it's something that happens there at Easter. I think those are one of the ones out of that series. The one that's not so bright, but the oil and the trees and the background and all of these, mostly women and men, doing a procession around the tree.
You've received so many awards, we can't even get into it. And have been honored in so many different ways. But when you look back at this career, this 50 years
amazing.
This month,
which is
pretty incredible, and all chronicled in Living My Dream, the 50th anniversary celebration, what are some of the things you're most proud of that you've achieved?
As a self-taught artist, and 2010 was a big year for me in awards. As a self-taught artist, I received an honorary doctorate from St. Augustine's University for my body of work and for what I've shared. The same year, I received the Trumpet Award, first painter ever to receive a Trumpet Award. So that's my civil rights. And then that same year, inducted to the National Association of Women Business Owners Hall of Fame. All of that happened in 2010. Yeah, and very close together.
It was a very good year.
Yes. Yeah, I believe it was January, probably March and April, all in the beginning.
And does something like that, when you have a year like that with so many things happening, what does that do for you? Does that then motivate you
go
on more?
It's more humbling, yeah, because when I did my little bit of acting in the 70s, I got tired of it. I didn't like people being able to particularly recognize me. My mission in life was for people to be able to recognize my art. So that's the kind of feeling that when people began to recognize my art was much better for me. My first newspaper, they did an article on me for my France thing, 1980. They wanted to put this big old picture of me, and I convinced them to put a big old picture of one of my paintings and a little tiny picture of me. So it's humbling, all that attention. And you're around all this
humbling.
World.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Any notable figures in African American history that have really had an impact on you? Not necessarily artists, you know, anyone who has been a motivation for you.
Well, I'm going to add this. I do a lot of work with HBCUs and other colleges and universities throughout the United States. And so therefore I have topics I speak on. So one of them is my sheroes in the civil rights. My sheroes, civil rights. And they are Edmonia Lewis. Now that was a sculptor. 1865, she was already on a ship from Boston to Rome. And if you go to any museum, well, if you go to the National Museum Gallery in D.C., 10-ton sculpture, The Death of Cleopatra. She was a black Indian and not even my height. Okay, from around Niagara Falls and lived on the reservation, but also went to Oberlin. That's a short synopsis on Edmonia Lewis. And I also loved her. Her Indian name was Wildfire. She was really a wildfire for what she did. 6-7 weeks on a ship, just at the same time as Emancipation Proclamation's happening. She's in Rome. So she's a hidden treasure that people need to know more about. 1865. Now, that's some really spirit to go on and go for it back then. You know, so Catherine Dunham. Yeah, I love dance. I did take a little bit of Dunham technique. Believe me, I couldn't wrap a spoon around it. But anyway, same thing. The adventuresome anthropologist, you know, traveled and learned other cultures, developed her own style, her own technique. And then my girl, Lena Horne. You know, same thing. I had a chance to spend time with her during years of getting a little bit to know her and whatever.
So that was elegance personified, but tough as
tough.
Nails.
Yes.
Steel and velvet right there.
Yes. So those are my three sheroes, my primary. So I do a presentation about them. And so those are my three.
You are one of my sheroes. Let me just say that. And the work that you have done just is so outstanding. And you've been prolific. I mean, and there's no end in sight. And I think that's what I love the most about Cynthia St. James. You still love it, don't you?
Oh, my God. I'm doing a 3x4 foot painting right now. It's my 12th HBCU commission painting. And that's what's just all this blank canvases at home waiting for me to try to fill it in. That's the part. I remember it used to really terrify me in the 70s sometimes when I would look at an empty canvas. You know, I even wrote a poem about it, like this empty canvas that was staring at me, you know. Yeah, but it's thrilling to see it come about because I don't plan it. I let it come, you know, certain little things, but I don't know what it's going to look like. I have no idea.
She is thrilling herself as much as she is thrilling the rest of us. And we appreciate it so much. Cynthia St. James is making waves during Black History Month and beyond. Congratulations, and thank you so much for all your contributions.
Thank you for the honor. This is a big honor.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.